Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You might know this week's guest as one half of the Two Dope Queens, but she is so much more than that. This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and today I am joined by one of my favorite comedians and fellow podcast host, Phoebe Robinson. Along with The Daily Show's Jessica Williams, Phoebe spent several years co-hosting Two Dope Queens, first as a live podcast and then as a series of truly wonderful HBO specials. She also hosted the podcast So Many White Guys for WNYC and is now out with a brand new advice podcast. It's called Black Frasier, even though, as she tells me in our conversation, she has never seen a single episode of that very white 90s sitcom. Phoebe was also in the middle of shooting her new Comedy Central talk show, Doing the Most, when the world shut down back in March. But she is very hopeful that they can get it back up and running very soon. We talk about all of that, plus Phoebe shares her take on Kanye West's 2020 presidential platform, explains her irrational obsession with U2, and a lot more. So let's do it. Here's me with Phoebe Robinson. How's it going? Are you in New York?
Yeah, we're in Brooklyn in our apartment. We've been quarantined since March 6th.
It's been a while.
I know. What about you?
Yeah, I'm in LA, but same, been pretty much home since then. Getting pretty sick of it, but getting by.
Yeah, nice.
I was hoping California was like so chill for a while, and now it is not. So we were kind of like feeling cocky a few weeks ago. And
I know. Yeah.
But hopefully something will change eventually and life will go back to some sort of normal, but hard to see when.
I know. Yeah, it's bizarre. Very bizarre.
Well, yeah, thank you for doing this. I'm so excited to have you on the show and excited for your new podcast, Black Frasier.
Yeah.
Which I think when this episode drops will be hopefully the same day that your podcast starts so people can listen to it now. Tell us about it. What's the new podcast all about?
Yeah. So I kind of always wanted to do a podcast, like an advice podcast. And, you know, I just sort of got busy with a production company and stand-up touring and stuff. So I was always like, oh, I'll just do it later. And then when I was doing some of these IG lives shortly after like the uprisings that were happening around George Floyd and like each IG live, for example, like with Chris Hayes, it would be about police brutality. And then, you know, Abby Jacobson, it would be about cultural appropriation, or Ijeoma Oluo would be about like local politics and activism. And I would just see people like sort of like asking questions throughout in the comments. It really just made me sort of revisit this idea of doing an advice show. And so that's really how it came about. So each episode is based on one theme. You know, we have stuff where I'm chatting with, you know, Whitney Cummings about money and Hasan Minhaj about the collegiate system, the college system. And so then people DM me questions and the guests and I, we can have fun with it. We could also give like really like practical advice. And, you know, I really just sort of landed on the name. I've never seen Frasier. I will freely admit I've never seen it, but my boyfriend is from the UK. He's a big fan of the show. And we just thought it'd be funny to just call me Black Frasier because of the advice element. And that's really how it just came about.
You didn't even watch any as in preparation for the podcast just to see what it's all about? Not interested?
No, I saw some screenshots and I was like, I get it. But I do think I want to go and watch the show like in earnest.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe someday get someone from Frasier as a guest on your podcast. That would be pretty exciting.
I mean,
and
my
talk to them
goal
about how you don't know what the show's about.
I would watch all of Frasier before I did that, but my goal would be to get Kelsey Grammer on and just only have him talk about executive producing girlfriends. That would be like the only thing. Yeah.
And not about how he's a Hollywood Republican.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's a rare breed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on from Frasier to Black Frasier. are you someone who your friends have come to for advice over the years? Do you feel like you're good at giving advice?
Yeah, I feel like I just tend to either give solicited or unsolicited advice. And I always like try to be funny with it and not have it be like I'm telling people how to live their lives. So for me, it felt really sort of kind of like a natural extension of myself to put that into a podcast format.
Mm-hmm. What about advice that you've gotten over the years? Is there advice that really sticks out to you in terms of maybe comedy specifically, like how to manage your comedy career?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's just been from people along the way, whether it's like a lit agent or, you know, other people that I work with who just sort of, I like to do a lot of things, but I tend to get a little bit overwhelmed when I'm just dabbling all these I have probably 25 different jobs. And so one of the things that, you know, I've gotten a couple of times in my career has just been sort of like, not like calm down, but sort of like just take it day by day, because I tend to just always look at big picture and then go, how am I going to finish writing a book? How am I going to like self-produce a podcast? How am I going to do all these things? And so the reminder of like, not all of it is going to happen in one day. So if you take the pressure off and really try to enjoy the process, it'll actually go better. And the biggest piece of advice that I've gotten was from my former assistant. Her name is Mai. She now is like the office manager for my production company. She said to me, if you said yes to fewer things, you would actually be a more productive person.
Is that a problem that you have, saying yes to too many things?
Yeah. I mean, especially when you start out doing stand-up comedy, or if you know, I started out doing stand-up comedy and then also freelance blogging, right? So it's like both of those things where you have to hustle and say yes to every sort of gig in order just to make rent. And so I really tried for the first 8 years of my career, it was just constantly saying yes to every single thing so I could have some sort of income. And then we got to a place where it's like, you know, now I'm touring and I have a production company and I'm writing books. And it's just sort of like, you don't have to do, like, you don't have to go to Staten Island and do this stand-up gig that's going to pay 50, but like, don't do that. It's not a good usage of your time. And so it's allowed me to sort of think about not saying yes to everything because you're scared that if you say no, that all your opportunities will dry up, and just sort of trusting the process that like me saying no to these three things will allow me to the space to do this one bigger thing that I'm really excited about.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm such a big fan of the podcast that you were doing before this one, So Many White Guys. Kind of an inspiration for me as well as a white guy, thinking about, I feel like I did not recognize how white guy dominated the podcast space was until, you know, you were really talking about it and highlighting all these other voices. And so I think it has really encouraged me to, you know, book all different types of guests on my show and really keep it as diverse as possible.
Cool.
Can you talk about that show a little bit and what you wanted to achieve with it? And I know, is it done forever, do you feel like, or is it something that you would return to? Or
yeah, I mean, shout out to WNYC, which is the home for So Many White Guys and Two Dope Queens. And I did 4 seasons of So Many White Guys, and I love WNYC, but it's really hard. I think sometimes when you are sort of juggling having to like deal with the bureaucracy of sort of like a podcast network. And I think my schedule was also so hectic where I was traveling all the time that it made it really difficult. And I think with Black Frasier, I wanted to sort of do this kind of indie sort of grassroots thing that kind of went back to like how Jess and I started doing Two Dope Queens. Like, it didn't even start as a podcast. We're just doing it as a live show, UCB East. We got no money for it. And then we moved to Union Hall and we got like a little bit from the cover that we split with the rest of the comics on the lineups each show. And I feel like the thing that I really like about going indie is that you can really sort of like figure out the perfect voice and tone for your show so that when you go to sell it, it's like, this is a thing that you either are buying this or you're not. And you tend to have this proof of concept, which will allow you to get more money. So it's just sort of like me investing in this new endeavor to get it there. But with So Many White Guys, I mean, what I loved about it was, you know, coming out of like starting Two Dope Queens around the same time, it was great to do this sort of variety show and a podcast format. But I've always had this gift of gab and love talking to people. And I felt like when I would see a lot of my friends get interviewed, whether it's on print or podcast or TV, it would just be like, Janet Mock, so you're trans? And, or, you know, like that sort of vibe, as though there's nothing else about her other than that identity. And so with So Many White Guys, I really was like, well, there are all these people that I'm so, you know, I admire or I look up to, and I really just want to celebrate them and their work and talk about stuff in a really like real and honest way without othering them. And, you know, I'm thinking about like the Lizzo episode, which I think was the first episode, and how it was so great to sort of talk to her. And we talked about police brutality in Minnesota. Like, it was just like all this stuff that was really, really cool. And I thought it was just such a great home for it to take the pressure off of having to be funny all the time, which I think Two Dope Queens, Jessica and I felt that like we got to bring the jokes and we want to make people laugh. And so many white guys allowed for there to be a little bit of room to breathe. I would like to bring it back. I don't know what iteration because of my Comedy Central talk show, which is also interviewing celebrities. So it kind of didn't make sense to do that with so many white guys for the moment. But my workaround with this whole advice thing with Black Frasier, sort of like my way to kind of sneak that in, but really have it rooted in advice.
Well, I want to get to Two Dope Queens and the talk show as well. But just one more thing on So Many White Guys. The episode that really stands out to me that I remember best, I think, is the Terry Gross episode, which I just loved.
Oh, yay.
Your vibe with Terry Gross. And so I mostly just want to know, is there any follow-up there? Are you guys best friends now? What's going on with you and Terry?
We're not best friends because we're both workaholics. So we never got a chance to like visit the other in the city that they live in. So maybe after the quarantine, I'll be like, hey, Tear, let's go to a concert. Let's go grab brunch. What can we do? I really loved her interview style. Like I've always looked up to her.
Me too.
And her show. So to get her on, yeah, like she's just so amazing and smart. And she asks really great questions that gets these sort of like memorable moments out of people. So the fact that I was able to get her on So Many White Guys was just really, really fun. And I'm just like, oh, I love you, Terry.
And I think she's been interviewed like 3 times in her life and you're one of them. So
yeah,
she's
I'm
not
very
doing
lucky.
It a lot. It's very cool. So you mentioned Two Dope Queens, which, you know, is probably the thing that people know you best for now. So how did you, you know, you said it kind of started in these smaller venues. How did you meet Jessica Williams in the first place and decide that this was something you wanted to do with her?
Yeah, so this was 2014. I was about 6.5 years into just being a stand-up comic in New York, which meant I made no money doing stand-up comedy and I had a day job. But then I quit my day job at the end of 2013 to write on this pilot for the show that like didn't get greenlit. So I just, 2014, I was just like hustling and doing like whatever gigs. And I think I saw like I don't think it was Craigslist, but I saw a listing somewhere that The Daily Show was looking for background extras for this piece about Black women's hair in the military. And it was not paid. And I was like, you know, that sucks. But at least I could say when I do these small club shows, I could be like, as seen on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
And like, no one's going to fact check and realize that I was just a background extra with like no lines. So I was like, all right, I could do it. It's only like it's like a 3-hour shoot. That's totally fine. And so like, I actually, it took place at a hair salon in Midtown Manhattan. I met her in the elevator and we sort of had kind of like been not in the same circle, but we knew a lot of the same people because I started out doing improv in New York and she started out doing improv in LA. And you know, sets are kind of like, shoots are very boring. Like there's a lot of like sitting around waiting for lighting changes and all that stuff. So we sort of hit it off and we're just talking. And I invited her to do my very first podcast ever, which is called Blaria, which stands for Black Daria. And I was like, Jessica, it's like so legit. Like Wyatt Cenac was a guest on it. Like this isn't trash, you know? And she was like, okay. And so we filmed at my apartment, which had like, it was like, oh, my first apartment. It was just one of those things where you live in New York and your first apartment is like, your first solo apartment is like such trash, but you accept it because you're just like, that's what living in New York is.
Yeah, mine didn't have closets. Which I didn't realize until after I moved in.
Wait, where did you put your clothes?
You know, I figured it out.
Yeah, so it's just things like that. And my apartment had this massive like mold problem in my bathroom ceiling. So it was like super jank. She came over and filmed. She said her birthday was coming up and asked her what she wanted to do for her birthday. And she was like, well, you know, I've never done stand-up before. Like that would be a fun thing. And I told her, oh, I had this show in the city that I was hosting. We could just co-host it together. So what you see like on HBO or here in the podcast, that's literally was from the first show. That sort of back and forth banter. And that wasn't planned. It was just sort of, I was busy doing stand-up. Jess was busy doing the Daily Show. So when it came to the show, it was just sort of like, all right, you have three things you want to talk about. I'll have three things that I want to talk about. And then we'll just riff on stage. It'll be fine. And then it ended up being really, really good. And we were both kind of like, okay, that was there was a spark. This is a hot date. Let's just maybe do this again, you know? And we were not going into it with, this is going to be Two Dope Queens on HBO. Like, that was never the plan. This was just like a side, like a fun side thing. And then we just kept doing the shows and like gaining a popularity. And I remember I was like hounding Jason Zittleman over at the New York Times to just like sort of come to a show and write a profile. And he finally did. And it was just like really, really cool. And it was just like this nice organic thing that started out just celebrating different comics in the city who we thought should be more famous than they are. But, you know, I just feel like a lot of times women, people of color, queer people don't necessarily get those opportunities. And so we're like, well, we'll just have them on our show and maybe that'll be fun and people really like, you know, that'll resonate with people. I've been in New York for 15 years now.
I love that it went from 7 to 15, or was it 17, 15?
It was going to be 17, 15. But, and I love New York, and I remember my first apartment in New York when I graduated college and I got my first, it was a basement apartment with two friends of mine, and yeah.
Do you just like basements, or is it friends? Never mind, we'll talk after.
Yeah. But yeah, that was my first apartment. It was like all we could afford. It was like in this nurse's, it used to be an old hospital. Mm-hmm. So it was like in the nurse's wing.
Haunted. So it haunted. Was very haunted.
But
was it haunted?
I don't know if it was haunted, but we definitely like lived in the basement. So that's probably where like the cadavers hung out.
I would throw some cadavers down there if I owned an old hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, because, you know, we did our show in New York at the Bell House. It's a 400-seater. And some days we would just, like, show up with, like, no makeup on and sweatpants and, like, a cool, like, Aaliyah shirt or, like, a Led Zeppelin t-shirt. And just, it was so chill. Like, we were just hanging with the homies. But then once it got to HBO, we were like, this is the big leagues. Like, this is what so many people in comedy, like, aim for. So I think we definitely felt, especially for the first season, I will say for myself specifically, like, I don't think I enjoyed it as much as I did because I was so in my head about it being HBO and we're in this big theater that's like holds 3,000 people and has all this sort of, you know, history behind it. And I just didn't want to screw it up. I'm like, we're on the same network as Game of Thrones and The Sopranos and Sex and the City. And I want to make sure our show is right up there with them. And so it did feel kind of wild. And the first night we taped, Jess and I walked out and we got this like huge like standing ovation. I started to tear up a little bit because I never expected any of that to happen. And I was just so grateful that, you know, people love the show so much. And we would get these DMs where it's like, oh, I'm flying from Seattle to New York for the taping, or like, you know, my mom was sick and had cancer and like this show was like a podcast that I listened to and helped me like take my mind off of it. And so us hearing those messages, it kind of made us be like, yes, it is about the moment. It is about HBO and the costume changes and everything. But it is also about that we created a product that really resonated with people and made people feel like stand-up comedy is not just like this white guy thing, you know? And it's something where it's like, oh, I could hear like different perspectives and I could see myself reflected. And so that, to me, at the end of the day, I always reminded myself it's about this connection that we were able to build with the people who listened to the podcast and watched the show.
Yeah, and it created such a great platform for all the comics who were on it, who mm-hmm. I think didn't, you know, maybe get that same kind of opportunity elsewhere. Are there certain ones that stand out to you in your mind that just like really crushed in that setting?
Yeah, I think of Solomon Giorgio, who was so phenomenal and is a writer on Shrill and High Fidelity. And he was just so funny. And he just sort of like, he represented the best parts of the show of like just being cool, calm, going with the flow, not taking yourself too seriously, but like making your presence known. I thought he was fantastic. Shang Wang, I loved. I think of everyone, he's my parents' favorite. They were were like, we love Shang Wang, which is like so cute. Michelle Buteau, I thought was fantastic. John Early. I really feel like everyone that we had on the show really just wanted to have a good time. And they're all professionals. They're touring. They're doing festivals. They're acting. So they know like, okay, you want 6 minutes from me? You got it. You know, yeah. It was so
and
great.
And they gave you like the best 6 minutes. I mean, I feel like everyone just really delivered. What about, you had so many great guests on the show too, the sort of celebrity guest portion of it. Were there any moments from that that really stick out to you?
I think Lupita is just, she was so fun, and you just never know because you're like, oh, she's an Oscar winner, and like, you know, she trained at Yale. Like, you just never know, like, if she's gonna be like stuffy, but she was like so loose and like freestyle rapped with us, and that was really fun. I think Jon Stewart was great. You know, he's just, he's like so like New York, New Jersey, that it was just like really sweet to like shoot here and have him do it. Lizzo was fantastic. And so I really think we got really, really great people on. And I feel like every celeb that came into it just was kind of had the, like, I don't have to be sitting here promoting my project the entire time or telling some like silly story about like my landscaper did this at my house. Like, they just got to be goofy and silly. And so I feel like when we did that, it just made it that much more fun because they were all just having a good time as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of sort of that late night talk show thing, you have this Comedy Central show that got announced a while ago. And was it supposed to be kind of on now during the summer? Was that the original goal?
Yeah, we stopped production.
Brutal.
So it was like we're doing a 10-episode order and we shot 6 and then COVID happened. And so then we stopped down production. And so we're actually trying to see if we can. I know we're in phase 4 here in New York, which I'm like, LOL, who?
Yeah.
We could go back to phase 1 tomorrow, you know? We're trying to see what happens here with COVID. And then also we're, you know, going to make sure we put like a safety plan in place. Because I would like to shoot the last 4 episodes this year so we could come out early 2021. But if not, then we'll just shoot it at the beginning of next year and then have it come out next summer or something.
What's the sort of concept behind the show? And has it changed in your mind at all, you know, given everything, whether it's the shutdown or the protests or anything? Like, has that made you think about what you want to do differently with the show?
Yes. Yeah. So it's called Doing the Most with Phoebe Robinson. And the general premise behind it is that because I am such a workaholic, I actually don't have a ton of life experiences or skills. Like, I don't know how to drive. I've wanted a tattoo for a decade, never gotten it. I'm afraid of heights. I'm like not the best cook. I'm not really a good baker. I'm always scared of getting injured. I don't know how to play any sports. So it's just all these sort of things I was poking fun at myself about being like so work-oriented throughout my 20s and early 30s. And then, you know, I was just like, well, you know what I always found interesting is that celebs, when they would do these interviews, and they would always have these hidden talents, right? And you could just see when they were doing their hidden talent, like how sort of calm they got. Like when Lupita was on Two Dope Queens and she was just braiding that hair, like, because she's a good braider. So it was just like so chill for her.
But wait, Lupita, I know you're doing a movie with Jordan Peele while we start.
Oh, you're cheating.
How was it to work with him?
Oh, I loved working with him. He has a very, very strange
Lupita,
mind.
Lupita, look over there, Lupita. There's something
talk
over there.
Talk to us about Jordan
Somebody
Peele.
Wants to talk to you over there.
Lupita.
No, no such thing. No
Lupita.
Such thing. No such thing.
Hold on. No, no. You're not getting me, no.
Lupita.
Okay, see, let's...
Okay. We're trying.
I'm the movie us.
This is stressful.
Lupita.
This is the way to make me slip and say things
First
about
all,
us. That I'm not supposed to.
Okay.
Except
you know
that
what?
It's coming out in on March 15th, okay?
Okay. And I was like, it would be cool to like interview a celebrity, but then when we're doing an activity, they are in a position of being the expert and I'm the uncomfortable one. So they get that moment to feel really good while we're having, you know, maybe a deep conversation. And then people could see me be sort of like uncomfortable and try and figure things out. And I just thought it was just like a good marriage of sort of like discomfort and seeing celebs in a different, you know, sort of light. And like one of the episodes, Tan Fran, is teaching me how to bake because he's done like some baking competitions and he's really good at it. And so that was like fun and light. We got to do that stuff. But then it was sort of when we were having the interview portion, we have this segment on the show where it was just so silly, but it's like a big spoon, little spoon. So I like get to hold like the celeb guest for a little bit.
Everyone's down with that?
Yeah. I mean, pre-COVID they were.
So
yeah.
far. Yeah.
yeah. And so we would have like maybe I asked them like sort of three like deep questions. And, you know, I feel like in those moments, it's been really cool to have like Tan sort of opening up about like, you know, growing up or like Kevin Bacon sharing the story of how he actually met his wife, Keira Sedgwick, like years ago and like didn't remember her. Like, so all these like really fun, fascinating moments that like you don't necessarily get to see if you're on, you know, a late night talk show and you only have 5 minutes and you got to do like a bit that's going to go viral and do like an interview. I really feel like this show is allowing them to be like their most comfortable selves and people get to learn a little something.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting the way late night TV has been like totally upended by this, you know, both, as I said, with the quarantine, everyone's shooting from home, not in the same place. But then when the protests started, there was this like really intense thing happening on late night TV that I was watching, especially with so many white guy hosts kind of like being like, OK, I think we need to talk about this in a serious way, in a way that we haven't before. Is that something that you were watching at all or were aware of? Because I know you also you went on Jimmy Fallon's show pretty early on in that whole thing when he was having a lot of serious conversations all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things where it's, I don't know what it is about this time period where, you know, Black Lives Matter has been around since what, 2013, 2012, maybe something like that. And it had a lot of momentum then. But like now to see the uprisings happening in a global level to a degree that's never happened before for a civil rights movement like this, it's really sort of exciting. And I think it was just kind of, whether it's Fallon or these other late night hosts, sort of acknowledging that like we can't just go along and pretend like everything is business as usual. We do actually need to have these conversations. And I think it's good to have them, but I also want them to, I want it to be more than just like having a conversation in June. You know what I mean? Like, I want it to be like, what is the makeup of your staff behind the scenes? Like, how are you operating going forward in your everyday life, whether it's at like your school or at your grocery store in your or your neighborhood? So I think it's good that this is happening, but I don't want it to be the only thing that happens.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel weird at all about going on that show to kind of like tell Jimmy Fallon what he should be doing or that kind of thing?
Honestly, I didn't feel weird. I was like, you know what? It felt like it was coming from a very genuine place. And he was just like, look, there is a lot to learn. And I think, you know, for me being a Black woman, a lot of times whenever there's a discussion about race, people just go to Black men as if they're the only people who experience any sort of racism. And like, you know, you look at Black Lives Matter, like that started by Black women. And so I think it was really nice to sort of acknowledge that, like, you know, Black women are doing a lot of the work and to have like my input and my insight alongside, you know, like W. Kamau Bell is like, was really nice. And I appreciated that.
One thing I was looking at, where you can't kind of get away from, if you do look at social media, is that a lot of people are saying it's not a Black person's job to tell white people, teach allies how to be allies.
Yes.
And so I was wondering what your take on that is. I mean, I know it's not your job to teach me how to relate better, but how would you kind of lay it out for anyone who's watching?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, whenever you're curious about something, we have the internet. And so if people can sort of go on Yelp to find the best tacos and spend like 2 hours searching for fajitas, you know what I mean? No one's confused about how to do that. But when it's about, you know, social justice and really showing up and being an ally and making things better, I feel like there's this tendency to be like, oh, I don't know what to do. I need help. And it's like, I already have a job. I can't take on another job. I can't do it.
Late night TV has been so white male dominated for so long and, you know, not a lot of women, certainly not a lot of women of color. So, I mean, I know your show is not obviously not a traditional late night show, but what does it mean to you to have your voice in that space and kind of enter that world?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really nice to sort of be able to do it. And it makes me think about people like Joan Rivers having her own show, or Arsenio Hall having his own show. And it just makes me, I'm not saying I'm on their level, you know what I mean? But it's just more like they have paved the way for someone like me to have this opportunity to kind of do a show that I want, that's maybe a little less traditional. Like, there's no monologue and there's no like man on the street sort of segments. It's really like an intimate one-on-one thing. Like, I always call myself like a low budget Oprah. So this is like my, you know, sort of like Nordstrom Rack version of like a Super Soul Sunday moment with more dick jokes. So I really am excited by it, and I take it seriously, and I want to make sure I'm doing a really good job, and that, you know, the episodes are half an hour, and I want people to feel like after they watch it, they feel so good and they feel happy and they can like go to bed with a smile on their face.
Coming up, Phoebe looks back at some of her earliest TV gigs and later takes Kanye West to task for criticizing Harriet Tubman.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
So what I want to do now is the next part of the show. We're going to run through some of your credits from over the years, some of my favorite stuff that you've done, and just see if there's a story or memory that pops to mind, if that's okay.
Okay, great. Yeah, let's do it.
So the first one is your late night stand-up debut, which I looked it up, I believe was on Seth Meyers.
Yeah, right? It was. Yeah, 2015.
What do you remember about that?
That was in January. And that was, I had been trying to get a late night spot somewhere. Like, I think before it was like Letterman is the dream. You know, that's just, I think, every comic's dream. And then he sort of retired. And I was like, well, that's not happening for me. And I've been trying to get, you know, a set together, and like, just it wasn't able to happen. I just couldn't get on a late night show. And then there was an opening, and I think the booker at the time, Bart Coleman, had seen me. I think I'd done like At Midnight, a couple other things. And so he had seen me live, and he, you know, knew I was working on a set. And he was like, oh, we have an opening in a couple of weeks. Do you just want to give me a set that you have? And I was like, yeah, sure. So I think that night I like just texted a bunch of people. I'm like, can I just run 5 minutes on your show? And I found this like chill like indie show in Brooklyn, maybe like 80 people in the audience, and I just recorded my 5 minute set, and I was like, okay, I'm just gonna submit it, fingers crossed. And then they were like, yeah, you got it. And I was like, oh my god. And I remember I had my, oh god, where I get my little power blazer from, I think it was like a Zara power blazer with like my little like Levi jeans that didn't quite fit all the way. And I was just like, no matter what happens in my career, like no one can say that, no one could take this moment away from me. Like, your first time that you get on TV for stuff that you wrote is just so like special. And the crowd was like so fun and supportive, and Seth was so great. And my boyfriend at the time, my ex-boyfriend, no, he is now my ex-boyfriend, but he was my boyfriend then. I was like, wait, how do I do that? It was like, he was there. One of my closest friends, Nori Davis, who's also a stand-up, and we went to college together. So we had a lot of friends from like when I was younger there. And it was just, it was so great. It was like really one of my favorite, I think, moments from my career.
Yeah. I believe one of your first real acting credits was on the pilot of Broad City. Is that right?
Yeah.
How did that happen? And what do you remember about it?
So I knew Alana and Abby from the beginning of them doing their web series. And Alana and I met doing a stand-up show. And so they did an episode of their web series that was like set like at a movie theater. And I think it was like Alana and Elliot were being too loud, and I was just one of the movie theater goers who was like telling them to shut up or whatever. And then when they sold the series, they were like, we have a part for you. Would you want to do it? And I was like, yeah, of course, I'll do anything for you gals. Like, I love you. And it was just like, so I had like this little tiny baby fro, and it was like my first time really being on set. And I was like, can I go to craft services and like check out the bagels? And I was just making sure I knew like my two lines I think I had. And I just remember it being a really great set, a lot of high energy, a lot of like really kind people. And so it was cool to sort of be in the first episode of their show that really changed their lives. And so it was nice to be a witness to that.
And then did you end up working on the show later in some capacity or?
Yeah, I think I was a consultant on season 3. It did Punch Up.
Okay.
Which is like really cool and fun. And I think that maybe a year later, I ended up writing on Portlandia. Yeah.
You wrote on the last season of that show?
Yeah.
Was there a sketch that you worked on that show that stands out to you now or that was really meaningful?
Oh my gosh. This was what? Was this 3 years ago?
I think it came out 2 years ago. So yeah, you were probably working on it 3 years ago.
Oh my gosh. That is, time flies when you're stuck inside. I think there was one about dating that I worked on, and just about like how you're having it. Like, they will always make fun of me on Portlandia because I was so thirsty for a boyfriend, and I would always come into the writer's room complain about like some dude I talked about on Bumble or whatever. And I just wrote a sketch about like having to do like online dating, and that was like really fun to see something like that make it to air.
Hi. Thank God you guys
were here. We came as soon as we could.
Okay, so I got two phones. I've been texting with 8 different people, and I'm losing track. Okay, there's one guy. We're just communicating via Family Guy quotes, and things Stewie said.
Slow down.
We can handle this.
Okay. What's that? Okay. Oh, but,
Rachel, welcome to the command center.
So I'm going to handle the deep thinking guys that are looking for something intellectual.
I'm going to handle all the jokey guys who don't want to come off too serious.
Okay, what should I do?
You should handle the guys that immediately send pictures of their dicks or are just here for sex.
Got it. Okay.
But I think my favorite memories were just like Fred and Carrie are just two of the funniest people I've ever been around in my entire life. It was just wild how we would just be like having a conversation about nothing and my stomach would just hurt from laughter. So I think that was like my favorite part, was just like how wonderfully funny they were, and also how they led a writer's room in like just such a collaborative, really fun way. And I feel like everyone had a hand in everyone's sketches, which is why I'm like, oh, it's really hard to think of like one that I specifically wrote by myself, because it was such a team effort on every single sketch. But those sorts of things where you're always nervous when you're like, I'm coming into this writer's room, the two leads, like, are they going to be receptive? Are they going to play favorites? And there was none of that. So I think I'm actually going to be spoiled whenever I'm in another writer's room and be like, if you guys don't act like Fred and Carrie, I'm leaving, you know?
You mentioned Kevin Bacon's on your show, and I imagine that you met him on I Love Dick.
Yeah.
And Marfa, which was such a great show, and you were so great on it. And that was like your first sort of like regular role on a show mm-hmm. like that, right? Mm-hmm. So what was that like being down there? And you shot in Texas, right?
Yeah, I was intimidated the entire time. I was like, I don't belong here. It's like Kevin Bacon and Catherine Hahn. I'm like, these are two powerhouses. And then they were like so nice. And like, and you know, this was like, I think when You Can't Touch My Hair was going to come out. And like, I didn't tell anyone there that I was like, I wrote a book. Like I was being like, I'm like, oh, I just do stand up and like, that's it. And then I think that like Kevin somehow found out that like I wrote a book, and he was like, I want to read your book. And I was like, what? I was like, are you sure? He's like, yeah, you wrote a book. Like, why do you tell people? And so I like gave him like a copy of the book, and then he like promoted it online, and he was like, it's so funny, I love your book. And I was like, what is happening? Like, how is this a thing that's going on in my life? But what I will say is, like, even though I was very intimidated, I feel like I learned a lot being on I Love Dick. And I think that like one of the things that I learned was like Kevin and Catherine never, like, even though they were like number one on the call sheet, like, they didn't make everyone feel like, oh, I'm number one and the rest of you guys are just like scrubs or whatever. And so it was just sort of like everyone was treated with respect and kindness. And being a Marfa is like really, I was like, it was so cool and interesting. It's like a place I would have never ever thought to go to. And you know, you got to meet so many different people. Like, Marfa is very specifically not a place about like, I'm gonna pursue all my dreams and like sell my TV show and then like do movies, like, they're real people with, like, real sort of, like, life problems and, like, dreams and stuff. And so it was really cool just being around people where Hollywood was, like, not of any interest to them. It was really nice. Yeah.
No, I'm sure that was an incredible experience. You had a solo show that you did called Sorry, Harriet Tubman. And I was curious, just because this is in the news this week, what you made of Kanye West's attacks on Harriet Tubman, which came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. So doing that stand-up tour was so fun, and I was gearing up to sort of, like, do, like, a whole special with it. So now we'll see what happens. The thing about it is, like, I feel like stand-up and concerts are going to be the last things that come back, because it just requires that immediacy of contact and laughter and, like, participation. But yeah, that whole thing about just Kanye is just, it's one of those things where I want to say, I think there's a lot of things that are happening. One, obviously there's some mental health things that are going on. But two, I think is really tricky with famous people in particular when they're going through something and then people want to show up for the spectacle, right? Because I think to me, it's like you're sort of treating this person going through a mental health sort of situation as entertainment. And so, like, I know people are posting, like, his speeches online. I'm like, I don't want to contribute a view to it. But in terms of the whole Harriet Tubman thing, I think if there's just a lot of, like, I don't know where this stuff comes from. And, like, I just, there's a lot of, like, anti-Black stuff that he says that I don't quite get, like, even the things about, like, well, back in the day, I wouldn't have been a slave. It's just like, you would have, like, we just would have been, like, what are you talking about? You know, it's just such an ignorant thing to say that makes it seem like, oh, they just didn't try hard enough not to be slaves. I'm like, have you read a book? So it just, to me, I feel like attacking these figures who are symbols of freedom, who put their lives on the line to make life better for all Black people, I just feel like that is not the hill you want to die on. And I wish he would stop saying stuff like that. I don't know where it comes from. I wish I had the answers, but it really sort of is, like, I just think it's harmful rhetoric to be out there. And I think we if anything right now, we should be celebrating these figures like Harriet Tubman, who helped slaves get to freedom. Like, we should be commending that, not like being like, oh, this person's trash. It's like, of all the people, I'm gonna say Harriet Tubman is not trash. You know what I mean? Like, she's good.
Yeah. So the last one I wanted to ask you about is you interviewed Michelle Obama 5 times on her Becoming tour, and I know you guys are friends now, so that's exciting. But from all of your time spent with her, is there a moment that sticks out or that was very special spending with her?
Yeah, so I did 3 shows in the States and the 2 overseas. It was, what was it, Oslo? Is that it? I can't remember. I have to look at my calendar. But we did 2 sort of overseas shows. After one of the shows, I think she was just like, hey, what are you doing after this? And I was like, what? Like, it just had never gotten to this moment.
You guys hadn't socialized yet.
Yeah, like, we had, like, you know, talked before shows and everything. But, you know, because she's always flying from to the next city, this was, like, the first time where we were back-to-back cities together. And I was like, I don't know. What are you doing? Like, where is this going? And she was like, oh, well, I'm having a group of people come hang out at my hotel after this. And I was just like, oh my God. Like, I was just like so excited. I was freaking out. And her staff is predominantly like female and women of color. And I was just like the coolest thing. And she was so lovely. And she was just like, we're just hanging out, having grilled cheese sandwiches. Like, I'm like, what is my life? Like, why am I eating cheese with Michelle? And I remember, because my boyfriend used to be a tour manager, he was on the road and I was trying to text him before. I was like, oh, I'm going to hang out with like Michelle Obama. He's like, I'm too busy to text. And I was like, okay. I was like, but I have, like, did you see this text? Like, this is huge. And he was like, I'm too busy, I can't get into it. And I was like, all right. And so then when I was hanging out with Michelle at the like after show event or whatever, and he FaceTimes me and I go, are you too busy for this? And then I like turn the camera and he sees Michelle. He's like, oh, hi, how's it going? And so it's just really cute that she was just so fun and lovely. And I think the thing that I like most about her is a lot of young people would come to the, first of all, she was packing arenas. So it'd be like 20,000 people are showing up to hear someone talk about a book, which like never happens. And there'd be a lot of like college age people that would come. And And to just see the sort of time she spends and sort of like nurturing them and listening to them. And then she would always like try to do like some other activity, whether it's like surprising a book club or going to some sort of after school program, and just her really paying attention to the youth and supporting them and wanting to tell their stories. And it just really touched me how much she cared when she could just been like, I'm famous, I'm rich, I'm just going to show up and do my thing and leave. And it was like, she wanted to leave her mark on every community that she visited. And I was just like, wow, what an icon. It was really, really cool.
Have you been in touch with her at all during quarantine? Do you know how she's doing? What's going on? Is she baking?
Yeah. I think the last time we texted was for Mother's Day, because I just sent her flowers. And so it's just like,
that's
a hope.
Very sweet.
Well, I try to, because I'm always like, I'm not going to have kids. But like so many people I know have kids and I see how hard the work is. So Mother's Day, I'm like, everyone's getting flowers. So that was like the last time we chatted. And it was just like, you know, I think like here and there during COVID, it's just sort of like, hope you're well, hope you're safe, blah, blah, blah. I know everything is really nutso right now. So those kind of been the text messages lately, because I think honestly, no one thought we would still be in this position, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, she's the best.
So we end every episode by asking comedians, who is a comedian in your life who has made you laugh the hardest? Could be someone that you know, someone that you've seen on stage. Who's someone that really just gets you?
You know, I feel like there are two people, Ali Wong and Nate Bargatze. Have you seen his Netflix special?
Yeah, he was on this podcast a little while ago. He's great.
I've watched that special like 5 times and I laugh so much. Like those two, I'm just like, I will show up for anything that they do.
Yeah.
They're great.
And then for you, we're going to have a bonus final question, which is, which U2 song best represents where you are in your life right now?
That is a wonderful question. Wow. I've never been asked that before. Okay, what UT song? Okay, can I look at my phone and look at my...
Yeah, you can do some...
Oh, gosh. This is like...
I don't want you to rush an answer. You know, you gotta get it right.
Do you care much for UT, or are you sort of like, I'm good?
I like them. I'm not like you, but...
Yeah.
You
know. I mean, I think that's good for everyone. I'm kind of a mess.
I mean, I'm a Fish fan, so, you know, I get shit too. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm always like, you know what? Just let people enjoy what they want to enjoy, you know? Okay. Ooh. Okay. What represents me right now? I mean, I'm not wearing my finest clothes right now, so maybe... I'm going to say Beautiful Day. I think that is a song that always sort of like uplifts me. And I think that in this next, or like this current phase of my career, like I think I'm definitely thinking about like, yes, of course, I want to make people laugh. Yes, of course, I want this stuff I do to be a platform for other people to express themselves. And I think now I'm adding in a third factor where it's like, I want people to feel hopeful and uplifted after consuming whatever content of mine they're consuming. It doesn't mean I'm like pretending like everything's amazing, because I'm not. But I think it's more like just remembering that there is some good in the world, and that, you know, you can love yourself and you could strive for better, and that even though life is really hard, it doesn't have to be hard 24/7. So I think that song represents that for me.
Well, that is beautiful. And it's probably the U2 song that I know the best, because my a cappella group sang it in college.
Oh, you're an a cappella group?
I was, yeah. It's been a long time.
Wow.
But that
awesome.
Was our U2 cover.
Yeah.
So that was fun. Thank you so much for doing this, and congrats on the new podcast and everything. And it was just such a pleasure to talk to you and get to meet you in this way. And maybe we can meet someday in person.
Yes, this was so fun. Thank you so much. I'm going to make sure I do this recording right. There's no room.
Yes, that was my college a cappella group singing Beautiful Day. You're welcome, Phoebe. You can subscribe to Phoebe's podcast, Black Frasier, and listen to the first episode right now, wherever you get your podcasts. And hey, please do us a favor and give this podcast a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.